Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
House. This morning, President Bush said thanks and goodbye to his press secretary of 3 years, Scott McClellan, who announced he's resigning.
One of these days, he and I are going to be rocking on chairs in Texas talking about the good old days of his time as the press secretary, and I can assure you I will feel the same way then that I feel now, that I can say to Scott, job well done.
Also today, the White House confirmed that presidential adviser Karl Rove will be shifting gears away from policy development and will instead focus on this year's congressional elections. Well, joining us on the line from Washington is John Mercurio, senior editor of The Hotline, the daily political briefing of the National Journal. John, to Scott McClellan's resignation first, as the president tried to leave for his afternoon event, the radio on his helicopter didn't work, and it forced the president to disembark and wait for a motorcade. And it seemed to underscore that with this resignation, the president had communication problems.
Well, I think that was just an unfortunate, coincidence of circumstances. But yes, I think Scott McClellan's resignation has been widely expected within Washington for several weeks. It's not just McClellan. I think most reporters, despite the contentious relationship that we've developed with him over the past year or so, would acknowledge that he's done a relatively good job. But it's a sort of a larger problem within the White House communications shop, from Dan Bartlett, the communications director and senior advisor, on down. And I think that's what the White House is trying to tackle right now.
And the problem is what? And again, this is from the perception of a White House reporter, but the problem you'd say is what?
It's just an inability on the part of top administration officials to articulate a coherent message, which they were able to do extremely well during the president's first term, a coherent message on the top issues, the president's top agenda items, whether it's the war in Iraq or the economy or Social Security last year, which was a reform program that he ultimately had to abandon. And I think that part of that change has to do with another move that we saw today, which was the president's decision to take away Karl Rove's policy portfolio and have him focus much more exclusively on politics in the 2006 midterm.
Well, it was only a year ago that Rove was promoted to deputy chief of staff in charge of most policy coordination. Now, some would say he's a whiz at the at congressional races as well, and perhaps the White House felt they needed his expertise there. But do you see this as a demotion?
Well, that's interesting. There's a lot of whispering going on today within the White House and within Washington about whether or not it was actually sort of a mistake to give Rove that policy portfolio last year. It was viewed as a reward from the president to Rove, his architect of his reelection campaign, as a reward for the work that he had done trying to expand his portfolio. Is it a demotion? I mean, I think the White House would say no, that they recognize that he's a political expert, a campaign and elections expert, and needs to focus on that. But I think the bigger question or the bigger point that's being made is that this is a White House that recognizes that Republicans facing midterm elections are in trouble, and that they need Rove to focus on that.
Well, the president's new chief of staff, Josh Bolton, signaled that there would be a house cleaning, announcing this week that anyone who was going to resign in a year should do so now. The political newsletter, ABC's political newsletter, The Note, says that the conventional wisdom is that McClellan would go, so he's gone. Then Treasury Secretary John Snow, and then a prominent cabinet member still to be named, and eventually Rumsfeld. So in the minute or so we have left, a lot of people are waiting for shoes to fall. How many do you think will?
It's such a difficult question to ask. I think this White House has shown over the past 6 years that they're extremely loyal to their top administration officials. My gut tells me that Donald Rumsfeld will not resign, especially in the middle of this sort of criticism, the middle of this sort of firestorm of criticism that he's faced from top generals. I think it would be a big admission on the part of the Bush administration that their war policy in Iraq is not working, and I don't think you're going to see the administration make such an acknowledgement.
Would you tell us what the buzz is about a prominent cabinet member?
Other than Snow?
Yeah.
And other than Donald Rumsfeld, mm-hmm. I have to admit I haven't read today's note, so I don't know which other prominent cabinet member they might be talking about. I know that Norm Mineta, transportation secretary, was very ill and was rumored to be on his way out. It looks like he though intends to stick around. I think Condi Rice in state is is sticking with her gun. So I really wouldn't be able to answer the notes buzz. Mm.
It would seem as if second term house cleaning, though, has begun, which is usual in most administrations. John Mercurio, senior editor of The Hotline, the daily political briefing of the National Journal. John, thank you.
Thank you.
New Orleans is struggling to meet the health care needs of its poorest residents several months after Hurricane Katrina devastated the city. A study released this week by the Mailman School of Public Health at Columbia University and the Children's Health Fund says families displaced by the storm are suffering higher rates of medical problems than the rest of the population. That study, which also says more than 50% of the parents and guardians surveyed have no health insurance, echoes the experiences of two doctors who've been helping to rebuild the health care infrastructure inside New Orleans. In the April 13th issue of the New England Journal of Medicine, the doctors describe an environment where patients are treated in tents and department stores and at one point at the zoo. The article says access to health care is almost non-existent for the workers from other countries who've come to New Orleans to help rebuild the city. Hospitals are having trouble getting reimbursed for treating poorer patients. And finally, it says the federal, state, and city governments are still not communicating months after the storm. Dr. Ruth Berggren worked at the HIV unit at Charity Hospital in New Orleans, which is still closed. She's also associate professor of infectious diseases at Tulane University Medical School. Welcome, Dr. Berggren.
Thank you.
We're also joined by her husband, Dr. Tyler Curiel. He's a professor of hematology and medical oncology at Tulane University Medical School. And they both join us from the studios of WWNO in New Orleans. Welcome, Dr. Curiel.
Thank you for having us.
And your article in the New England Journal of Medicine is a pretty discouraging one. You say 6 months after Katrina, healthcare is unacceptably primitive. Now, we know you also worked in Haiti and third world country. So really, is that what you're saying, that it's a third world feel in New Orleans?
I can give you an illustration. The other day, I was seeing patients in our HIV outpatient clinic, and a gentleman came in with a complaint of diarrhea. And I had to use my history-taking skills to discern what kind of pathogen might be causing his symptoms, because I cannot today order a test that will tell me if he has a bacterial cause or a parasitic cause. That is just like Gabon. That is just like Haiti. Worse is that today I cannot order a basic screening test for tuberculosis in the AIDS clinic. Today in New Orleans, that test is not available for uninsured people.
You're saying that somebody may be walking around with tuberculosis and you're not able to test for it, and that's how diseases start in areas of crisis in third world countries.
I would say that situation that I just described is worse than what I see in rural Haiti.
Well, you said something else too, and I want to make sure we're clear. You said uninsured people. What's the distinction?
The test would be available if somebody who had health insurance came in with the problem, because they would have access to one of several hospital centers here in New Orleans that are up and functioning that can provide these tests.
I'd love you both to go back and continue to paint the picture for us of what's happening there. For instance, how many hospitals are open, Dr. Berggren? How many beds are available? What's been that impact?
If you look at the whole surrounding metropolitan area of 21 hospitals, about 15 have reopened. In that whole metropolitan area, there are 2,000 of 4,000 beds open. And then within the city of New Orleans itself, it's a very small number of beds, perhaps on the order of several hundred.
A lot of elective surgery right now is being postponed because there aren't enough operating room staff to work in the operating rooms. I still can't get chemotherapy for my patients mixed up in my regular hospital's pharmacy. I have to order that chemotherapy in another city where it's mixed up, put in a delivery truck, trucked over to my hospital, and then I can administer it to our patients in our hospital, but after a lot of convolutions and red tape. For cancer care for uninsured patients in the city of New Orleans, it's really non-existent. There is no defined uninsured cancer program right now. So if you have cancer and you need therapy, diagnosis, follow-up, and so on, Charity Hospital should provide that care for you in New Orleans. Charity is shut down. University Hospital would have been the backup hospital to provide that care. That hospital shut down. And those patients oftentimes have to travel to Baton Rouge, which is 75 miles away. Now, bear in mind, if you don't have medical insurance, it oftentimes means that your resources are limited. So these are the same people that don't have cars. They can't drive to Baton Rouge. They don't have bus fare. They can't take the bus to Baton Rouge. So there are very significant issues.
They're the same people that couldn't get out when the hurricane first hit.
That's exactly right.
You know, it sounds crazy-making for a doctor. It sounds like a MASH unit, but, you know, in a war that the rest of the country doesn't recognize.
This country clearly knows how to deal with disasters. For instance, you're not going to have long medical delays on the battlefield over in Iraq that's half a world away because there literally are MASH units there, doctors, medical supplies, and so on. So the country clearly can mobilize to take care of people with many types of complex medical issues basically anywhere on the planet.
So are you saying, Dr. Curiel and Dr. Bergen, jump in as well, are you saying that New Orleans needs the military to come in and run the medical establishment?
I don't think it has to be the military, but our society needs to look hard at what's happening here and ask some very tough questions. In the little town of Mirbalay, Haiti, where I work, there are two people who do nothing all day but collect smears on tuberculosis patients and perform the test and look under the microscope to diagnose whether they have active TB or not. Why on earth would we as a society not choose to make that simple service available in a U.S. city?
The United States has the money, the resources, the technology, and resolution could be affected through the federal or state governments with resources that we have and which we're not afraid to use when we go to war.
Well, I was going to ask you, and I think you just said it, where is the disconnect? I mean, who's not asking for it? Who's not delivering it? I mean, is it the cities not asking for it? Have they asked for it and not gotten it? I'm just looking for the disconnect.
Well, you can just go back to day one. My wife and I were both trapped in the hospitals when Hurricane Katrina hit. We were there for 5 days after the flooding, and we kept looking at each other then and saying, who's running this show? Because FEMA would say on TV, we're waiting for the state to ask for help, and the state would say, we've asked FEMA, but they're not doing things fast enough. And the city would be saying, we're looking to the state. So there's a lot of disorganization, but somebody needs to identify the problems and fix those problems. Don't fix the blame. We have a problem. Fix it.
Dr. Tyler Curiel is a professor of hematology and medical oncology at Tulane University Medical School. We're also speaking with Dr. Ruth Berggren, associate professor of infectious diseases. The two are husband and wife, and they write about the state of healthcare in New Orleans post-Katrina in the recent issue of the New England Journal of Medicine. But when we come back, we want to hear more about their experiences in the days immediately after Hurricane Katrina, floating around in rowboats, trying to reach each other between hospitals. Dr. Curiel shot at. We'll hear more about that when we come back. And later in the program, as Chinese President Hu Jintao visits the U.S., we'll hear how the Chinese language is becoming one of that country's biggest exports. You wonder who's behind the push for Americans to learn Chinese? It's the Chinese. There's more coming up here and now. After Hurricane Katrina continues, with Dr. Ruth Berggren, Associate Professor of Infectious Diseases at Tulane University Medical School, and Dr. Tyler Curiel, Professor of Hematology and Medical Oncology at Tulane University Medical School. They're both also married, and their article about New Orleans healthcare appears in the April 13th issue of the New England Journal of Medicine, and they've been in crisis mode since Hurricane Katrina hit. Before the break, we were talking about the disorganization after the hurricane, but, you know, in those few days after, you were both trapped in the city, in the hospitals, patients were being moved to higher floors as floodwaters were rising, many patients dying. Dr. Curiel, you were actually shot at. Dr. Berggren, you were working at Charity Hospital that weekend?
Yes, well, I was assigned as the teaching physician to the HIV ward for Charity Hospital the weekend that the storm hit, so we couldn't make plans to evacuate. Tyler, my husband, was not on call that weekend, but he elected to stay because I had to stay. We made our preparations very early on Sunday morning, the day prior to the hurricane striking, and went into the medical center and split up so that my husband and son were at Tulane Medical Center, and I went over across the street to Charity Hospital to run the HIV service.
Some of the orthopedic residents brought a canoe in, and so I was taking the canoe across every day to go check on my wife, and we had a stash of some food and some fluids to drink, and so we were making sure that she had something to eat and something to drink, because food and drinking water was always an issue. And we also took the canoe down to University Hospital, which is about half a mile away, and just check on our medical staff that were at that hospital. And on that trip, there were people in the water that had been in the water for several days, and they were rushing the canoe, trying to get it from us and making threats. But several days after that, we decided to stay in Charity rather than evacuate and help them until they were evacuated. And we were on the back of the loading dock getting patients into trucks. And we were sniped at by a sniper that was in a parking deck across the street. And we were also shot at another time, and we were in Humvees that can go through the amphibious vehicles that can go through water. We were shot at.
Dr. Bergen, do we understand that there are actually doctors who have committed suicide, maybe in part because of the situation there?
Yeah, I think everybody in New Orleans has some degree of post-traumatic stress disorder, and it's an illustration of one more big deficit in our whole infrastructure. It's pretty difficult to find mental health providers in a timely manner, and beds have been shut down. But in any event, after the hurricane, we know personally two physicians who committed suicide, and the community believes, and in one case the family believes, that these were suicides that never would have taken place had it not been for Hurricane Katrina. The State Health Department has not provided any evidence for us that suicides are up, but clinicians feel that they are. And at a meeting I attended a few weeks back with the Medical Center of Louisiana at New Orleans, a staff psychiatrist stood up and vocalized his grave concern about the lack of mental health infrastructure, and he said, "We are seeing an epidemic of suicide."
Well, and deaths might be up. You write, as a crude indicator, there were 25% more death notices in the Times-Picayune in January 2006 than in January 2005. Do you think people are dying in New Orleans because of the health care?
We do. And some it's not just because the health care is poor. It's also behavioral changes associated with post-traumatic stress. So someone with a chronic disease such as diabetes or hypertension gets frustrated at the lack of services, difficulty finding a doctor, difficulty getting prescriptions filled. And so they stop taking care of themselves. They stop taking medicines the way that they should. Their diseases become worse. And then when they show up in our hospitals, they're usually quite, quite ill. Mm. And this perception is widespread throughout the city. I've heard this reiterated by nurses treating patients at the Common Ground Health Clinic, which is a free clinic. And I've heard it reiterated by transplant surgeons in the university hospitals. So we don't have good data about it, and it's an area that our public health school needs to investigate so that we can learn more. But we have this widespread perception.
Well, Dr. Curiel, it would seem like one piece of good news is that other states want to learn from perhaps New Orleans' mistakes, because this could happen to any city with any kind of a crisis. And are other cities reaching out to you?
My wife and I have both been asked to speak at various medical societies or various medical venues in several states now regarding our experiences, not so much to tell the war stories, but as a backdrop to discuss what do we need to do to be prepared for catastrophic system failures. Because we're all drilled and minor things, relatively minor things like the fire drills and which emergency exit do you take and so on. But we really have never been taught what to do with the catastrophic system failure And when the communications were utterly wiped out, there was no internet, no cell phones, no landlines, no walkie-talkies, no radios. One day we found some Marines, and we asked them if they could radio up to the Black Hawk helicopters to see if those were the helicopters that were supposed to be coming for an evacuation. And they said, we can't do that because that's Army and we're Marines or something like that. And they couldn't communicate with each other. So there are huge gaps in our preparedness for catastrophic failure. And it's hurricanes in some parts of the country, earthquakes in other parts, a lot of tornadoes in the last few days, flooding, natural disasters, hard to foresee issues that could come up. And we need to do a better job of planning for catastrophic failure and for emergencies and disasters.
Dr. Tyler Curiel, Professor of Hematology and Medical Oncology at Tulane University Medical School. Dr. Ruth Berggren, Associate Professor of Infectious Diseases at Tulane University Medical School. They're married, and they say that healthcare in New Orleans is worse than in many of the third world countries they've worked in. Their article about the situation appears in the April 13th issue of the New England Journal of Medicine. Well, this quick note, tomorrow on Here and Now, China tests its muscle on the political stage. Is the world big enough for two superpowers again? That's tomorrow. Stay with us. Much more ahead, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from WBUR Boston, where the program is touring Boeing's Everett, Washington plant today as part of his first state visit to the U.S. since becoming president. China recently confirmed plans to buy 80 Boeing 737 jets for $5.2 billion. But while Washington State is increasing exports to China, the rest of America isn't faring as well. The U.S. currently has a $200 billion trade deficit with China. That trade deficit, as well as China's artificially controlled currency, its growing thirst for oil, and its position on the nuclear programs of Iran and North Korea, will be on the agenda when Hu meets with President Bush tomorrow at the White House. But one Chinese export isn't likely to be on the table, and that's Chinese language. Beijing is making a concerted effort to spread Mandarin around the globe. The goal is to have 100 million people studying Chinese by 2010, and the hope is that Chinese will overtake English as the most spoken second language in the world. Michael Erard wrote about the so-called Mandarin offensive in this month's Wired magazine. He joins us from the studios of KUT in Austin, Texas. And Michael, as you note in your article, the Chinese government actually has an office set up to export language. Tell us about that.
The Chinese government has an office called the National Office for Teaching Chinese as a Foreign Language, also known as Hanban, which is in charge of a project called the Chinese Bridge Project. And what they're doing is sending abroad volunteer teachers. Last year, they sent about 1,000 teachers to 23 countries, I believe. They have a pool of 10,000 volunteers. They're also opening these Confucius Institutes, which are centers for language learning and culture. There are 6 currently planned for the U.S. There are 41 that are currently open in some fashion around the world, and they currently have plans to open 100 of these Confucius Institutes around the world.
And you note that the Chinese government is tracking this spread of Mandarin from their offices in Beijing. You went there. Describe the map that you saw that you mentioned in this article.
My editors at Wired had said, when they sent me there, said, we would really like you to find a map. Maybe they keep track of this stuff. And I thought, that's ridiculous. There's not going to be a map. Well, the meeting room, which is on the 16th floor of this office building where the Hanban offices are, and what do you know, there on the wall was a map. So we spent about 45 minutes talking about the way they had mapped, you know, the teachers and these cultural centers and also the testing centers. That's another part of the Chinese Bridge Project, is increasing the number of places where you can take the official Chinese proficiency test.
Right. We understand the map showed that the hottest markets for Mandarin are Thailand and South Korea.
Mm-hmm.
And then there were like yellow circles where there's teachers and red triangles where there's the test facilities, blue squares for the language centers. You know, some people hearing this are thinking, oh my gosh, you know, World domination.
World domination, right.
It feels like there's something nefarious about this. I mean, do you think there's reasons to be concerned about this?
As someone who aspires to be a Mandarin speaker himself, no. I mean, it's linked to so many other sorts of issues, you know? I mean, it's linked to current discussions in the U.S. about immigration. It's linked to various fears about, economic fears about outsourcing and the dependence of our economy on the Chinese economy. Should we fear this particular educational push, this cultural push? No.
Yeah. Why would China want to do it?
There had been a number of media reports, you know, over the last year about the increased popularity of Chinese. But all of those reports made it seem as if that was something that, you know, American parents were pushing their kids to do, or kids were realizing. It made it seem very grassroots, sort of from the bottom up.
Mm-hmm.
I started to notice that there was this top-down approach from the Chinese government, and I wanted to look at, you know, what their foreign policy interests are in doing this. And there are a couple, you know. One is their feeling that a global superpower deserves a truly global language. This is a sign that they have finally arrived. Another part of that, though, is by spreading the language and the culture and with this focus on education, they can make their rise to this superpower status seem soft and peaceful and not threatening.
I was going to say, maybe they took a page or two from the Americans who have been spreading popular culture.
Certainly. As I wrote in the article, there's the Alliance Française, the British Council, the Goethe Institutes. So the notion of language and cultural centers abroad is not a strange or a novel one. And I think that's another reason why people shouldn't necessarily fear the spread of Chinese.
Well, the U.S. State Department has designated Chinese a critical language. Last year, the Senate introduced the United States-China Cultural Engagement Act, which would set aside more than $1 billion for Chinese language and culture instruction in American schools. By the way, why is the U.S. so interested in getting involved?
You know, I mean, I think since 9/11, certainly there's been an increased awareness of the importance of having Americans learn foreign languages and more foreign languages.
Hmm.
And on the military intelligence side, you know, those languages are obviously Arabic, Urdu, Pashto, Farsi. On the economic side, the interest is in, you know, economically important languages like Chinese.
We understand in 2007, high school kids in the U.S. are going to be able to take the first ever AP exam for Chinese language and culture. How far do you see this going? Do you see this replacing Spanish or French or German as, you know, the thing that American kids will be speaking?
Parents and kids would certainly like Chinese to become more popular than other languages. The major problem is the lack of certified teachers in the U.S. and one of the college board's projects, in addition to developing the advanced placement curriculum and exam, is to try to make professional development opportunities available, not necessarily for teachers from China, but for the thousands of very good and dedicated Chinese teachers who are teaching Chinese here in the States in the Chinese community schools.
Michael, have you learned Mandarin?
I learned Mandarin when I went to Taiwan, actually, after college in the early 90s to teach English. Interestingly enough, spreading another global language put me in contact with another global language. And my students, you know, I would sit and ask my adult students, I would say, you have to learn English. You have to learn English. I mean, that's why you're all here. Does it make you angry at all? Do you resent that fact? And they said, no, that's the way the world works. English is the global language of business. They realized that if they wanted to succeed, they had to speak English. And they said, but maybe someday everyone in the world will speak Chinese.
Well, and can you sign off with some Mandarin?
I was afraid that you were going to ask me to do that.
Well, I'll get you started. Michael Erard, again, who wrote about the Chinese government's program of Chinese language instruction for Wired magazine, thanks for joining us.
Dajia Zaijian.
And that meant?
Goodbye, everybody.
Michael, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
And still to come, can you imagine an episode of American Idol where President Bush is one of the judges and an Iraqi terrorist is one of the contestants? Paul Weitz could imagine it. That's the plot of his new film, American Dreams. We'll ask him, what were you thinking? You're listening to Here and Now. The Supreme Court is hearing arguments today in a case that could be redefining the way the insanity defense is used across the country. Today's case centers on whether a mentally ill man convicted of killing an Arizona police officer should be in jail or in a mental hospital. Experts on both sides of the case agree that the defendant, Eric Clark, has been suffering from paranoid schizophrenia and was when he killed Officer Jeffrey Moritz in 2000. But the jury didn't accept his insanity defense, and Clark was sentenced to 25 years to life in prison. Well, we want to touch down on the case with George Washington University law professor and frequent Here and Now legal commentator and explainer, Jonathan Turley. Jonathan, welcome.
Thank you very much.
And, you know, if everyone agrees that Eric was a normal kid who then began acting oddly, in fact, this officer responded to a call about him, and everyone agrees that Eric Clark suffered from chronic paranoid schizophrenia, why doesn't he qualify for an insanity defense in Arizona?
Well, a lot of it has to do with another defendant, and that is John Hinckley. After Hinckley's attempt to assassinate Ronald Reagan, there was something of a fit among the states, particularly Republican politicians, but also many Democrats, were outraged that Hinckley was able to use the insanity defense successfully in the case, even though there really wasn't much debate that Hinckley was clearly insane. But the result was that many states, including Arizona, narrowed their definition of insanity to a point that it eliminated the most common types of insanity defenses. And what many of these states, including Arizona, did is they said, we just want you to be able to show that your insanity prevented you from knowing whether this was right or wrong, that you were incapable of determining right and wrong.
Right, and the defendant, under Arizona law, must not be able to understand that what he was doing is wrong. And a lot of advocates for the mentally ill say many people who are mentally ill know what they're doing is wrong, but they cannot stop themselves from doing it.
That's right. And in fact, a third of the states before the Hinckley case had an irresistible impulse test, which many psychiatrists said was the appropriate the way to address insanity. For example, if you look at people like Andrea Yates, she knew what she was doing was wrong, but she believed she was responding to demonic forces. And other people have killed their children and others, once again, knowing that it was wrong, but they believe that they're under orders from God. And, you know, this is, by the way, an issue that goes back all the way to the Bible. You know, we saw with Abraham and Isaac that Abraham was prepared to kill Isaac because he believed that God told him to do it.
Well, by the way, Andrea Yates, of course, the woman in Texas who killed her five children, is having a retrial. How might this current case before the Supreme Court, only the second time the court has dealt with a direct constitutional challenge to this insanity defense since the Hinckley case changed the laws in the 80s. How might this current consideration affect Andrea Yates?
It could have a big effect because the Texas law is quite similar to the Arizona law. The Arizona law has a number of other problems, including the fact that once you are deemed to have been brought into sanity, in this case with psychotropic drugs, after a couple years in the hospital, they don't allow you to introduce for the consideration of the evidence of your insane state at the time of the crime. And a lot of people are saying, now hold it, these are intentional crimes. You have to show that someone intentionally did the deed. And if this person was in the throes of psychiatric illness, don't you have to allow him to present that evidence?
Well, Jonathan, I want to make sure I ask you in just the minute we have that this all comes as 9/11 co-conspirator Zacharias Moussaoui is trying to convince his jury that he suffers, or rather his attorneys are trying to convince the jury that he suffers from mental illness and his life should be spared. He should be spared the death penalty briefly. Does this Supreme Court consideration of the Arizona law affect that?
I think it's more likely of an effect on cases like Yates than Misawi. Misawi's arguing insanity as a mitigating factor. That is, he's not arguing it. His attorneys are arguing that you should consider this as a mitigating factor. It's really not being considered at the merit stage, the guilt stage of the trial.
Okay. George Washington University Law Professor Jonathan Turley speaking about today's Supreme Court case dealing with the insanity defense in criminal cases. It's an Arizona law that's under question, but it might have impact on other cases. Jonathan, thank you for getting us started in our look at this.
It's always a pleasure.
Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now. For directing the sex-obsessed teen comedy American Pie. Then he nudged his main character into adulthood in About a Boy. Well, now Weitz is back and his characters are all grown up. Sort of. His new film, American Dreams, tells the story of a president who looks uncannily like George W. Bush, who's locked himself in his room with newspapers, something he's just discovered. Alarmed, his Karl Rove-like chief of staff announces a plan to boost poll numbers. It culminates in the president appearing as a guest judge on the American Idol-like TV show, American Dreams.
First off, no more newspapers. In fact, no more reading. Back to the regular briefing. Second off, we're going to up the dosage on your medicine. Third off, we're going on a publicity blitz to show the world that you're still going strong, still have the common touch. And to start off with, you're going to be a guest judge on American Dreams.
Are you sure that's dignified?
That's Dennis Quaid playing the president, William Defoe doing a cross between Karl Rove and Dick Cheney as the president's chief of staff. Hugh Grant channels American Idol Simon Cowell as the MC of the fictional American Dreams. Among the contestants, an Iraqi immigrant who's been asked by terrorists to wear a suicide belt on the finale of the show, and the girlfriend of an American soldier just back from serving in Iraq. Hey, it could happen. And Paul Weitz joins us in the studio with more about the film. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
What were you thinking?
Good question. I've observed myself in the strange situation of being told that we're at war right now, but at the same time I was just watching American Idol and going about my daily sort of cultural life in the same way as if nothing was happening. I guess there is some question as to whether it's appropriate to make a comedy about the most important things going on in our lives.
Sure. Big question. I was going to get to that.
to my mind, if you can't, then what's the point of doing comedy? I think that comedy can be an anesthetic in a good way or a bad way. It can be an anesthetic in a bad way if it's totally avoiding everything. And I think my hope is that if there are all these things that we're sort of stressed out about on a daily basis, such as terrorism or the competency of our presidency, if you go to a theater and laugh for an hour and a half, it might allow some pressure release in which one can think about things in a slightly different way.
Well, I have to say, there are laughs, and yet there were moments where I caught myself, for instance, Omar, who is this delightful character. He's the Iraqi immigrant who's a complete failure at terrorist training camp. And so he's sent by the terrorists to live with his relatives in Los Angeles, I believe. And he makes his way onto the hit show American Dreams. Now, we have a scene where Omar, played by Sam Golzard, has just told his Iraqi-American family he's going on the show. That upsets his very dramatic L.A. cousin, who was the one who was originally auditioned. Let's listen.
I'm sorry. Did you say they want you to sing on the show?
Mm-hmm. Isn't that amusing?
Congratulations, Omar.
Thank you.
Congratulations, Omar. That's what you have to say. Congratulations, Omar. Do you know how hard I've worked to get on this show? You've stolen my dream.
I am so sorry. I told them. I told them they had made a mistake. But do not worry. I will simply refuse to be on the television show. Yes? Yes? And then they must take you instead. They don't want me.
His cousin ends up being Omar's very funny dance coach. But then the terrorists track Omar down because they want him to kill the president, who, as we said, is going to be a guest host on the show. There's a scene where they're showing Omar the suicide belt they want him to use. On the one hand, it's very funny because there's a round button that says,
"Press here to explode yourself."
On the other hand, there was just a moment of, ooh, I don't like this seeing, you know, these people who look real to me talking about blowing someone up.
Well, I mean, frankly, the treatment of this show tune singing terrorist is probably straight out of Mel Brooks. and his character himself is like an early Woody Allen character, like someone who's the pawn of greater forces. There actually is a moment where Omar, the sort of bumbling show tune singing terrorist, has made it into the finale of the show, and he's stressing out about what he's going to do, whether he has a chance to fulfill his dream and possibly win the show, or whether he's going to go through with his mission that's been put upon him. And he says, I have to ask myself, can one ever truly ease one's own suffering by causing someone else to suffer? So, and that's immediately deflated with a joke afterwards. But I had to make sure that within this story was, it's a send-up of American popular culture, but it's also, there's a great affection for American popular culture in the movie because it contributes to that character making a good moral decision, actually.
Just put that thought together in your head for a second, that potentially American dreams, you know, and the American dream could make someone take off a suicide belt, you know, because he's going to win the, you know, the show.
There's also, there's like a really canned political speech that Dennis Quaid as the president gives. It's the kind of stuff that we're so used to hearing that we completely tune out, but it absolutely affects this guy who has this huge decision to make. So I thought it was interesting to not only show sort of the devaluation of political rhetoric here, but to show that all the things that we devalue actually have some meaning.
Well, staying with the president, we also have a scene where the Karl Rove-like chief of staff character discovers that the president is reading newspapers and he's not too pleased about it.
There is a lot of stuff in here. There's a lot of interesting things.
Well, yeah, there is a lot of stuff. They have to fill the pages with something. But I think interesting is stretching it.
Well, for instance, did you know that there are two kinds of Rakistanis? Actually, three kinds of Iraqis.
Do you mean Sunnis and Shiites and Kurds?
You knew about this?
Funny. And Dennis Quaid channels President Bush's mannerisms quite well. But this is something Saturday Night Live does every week. What would you say is different about yours?
Well, the great thing about having Dennis was the first thing that we said was we don't want this just to be a parody of George Bush. It's funny because some people from the right will be annoyed that I'm sending up the president and that it's, you know, it's rare that you have a movie where there actually are the mannerisms of a sitting president. And then some people from the left will be annoyed because Dennis, during the course of this movie, humanizes the character a lot.
We're not going to give away the ending, but if you could talk around it and say, because there are people, let's just put it this way, there are people who rise from ashes. What are you saying about the American dream and popular culture and that you would like to blow it up or that it can't be killed?
Well, I think both. I think that we're in a strange situation, which is that the best thing about our country is this sort of dream that everybody can become something they're not and everybody can better themselves. And that's also our most exportable thing. That's why people will say, oh, I love Americans and I love the American dream, but I hate America, you know, when you travel. What I would love is for that great thing to be extricated from what's potentially dangerous about America, which is that we feel like we can give everybody else our dream of being a functional liberal democracy. I imagine a lot of people would extricate the word liberal, but a Western-style democracy, and it's just not that simple. You can't just go into a place and take out a dictator and expect everyone to be able to function in the way that we do in this country. So I think that the two things are connected, and I think that we need to somehow be able to examine our myths. That was a bit of a flowery way of putting it, but honestly, that's sort of the core of the movie, beneath the fact that it's simply a comedy, I can tell whether it's working or not by how hard the audience is laughing or not.
Paul White's the writer and director of the new film American Dreams, with a Z, which takes on celebrity, American politics, and how they often intersect. Paul White, thanks very much.
Oh, thanks for having me.
With hope in their hands, sometimes it feels like we're stuffed to the seams, but it's everyone's God-given right to follow their dreams.
And this note, American Dreams is opening in theaters across the country this Friday. I'd love to know what you think of it. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
Every woman and man has their own destiny to dream.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here at